Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the, I'm Bob Hill.
Well, why not?
There you have it.
Somebody has to be.
Today, the Old Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah, it's old, nostalgic, fun.
It is.
I read it for... since I was a young farmer.
Yeah, I was going to say, not for 217 years,
no,
but for as long as you can read,
feels
probably.
Feels like it sometimes, yeah.
But it comes out in September, so the 2010 version will be coming out in September. So we're still looking at the 2009. We're a little slow to the cut. But, you know, this is the time of the year that you start to really look to the almanac to see when you need to plant stuff, what's going to go on, what kind of summer weather it's going to be, all of that. So we've got the assistant editor, Sarah Peralt, coming up here pretty soon to give us a rundown of what to expect.
It's relentlessly old-fashioned, which I like about it. Uh-huh. Almost anti-computer, yeah. Anti-computer models, and by God.
And old-fashioned is new again,
man.
If
my bones ache, it's going to rain.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And old-fashioned is new again,
well,
don't you think?
It'll be old and new again many, many times.
Many times over, thank goodness. And the tree peony, just about, Daddy called it the Cadillac of spring flowering.
It's a minor flowering, just got done flowering in the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Incredible, incredible plant. It's the plant of the gods, I call
it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and Roy Clem, who's one of the nicest guys in the horticulture business ever, has a farm in southern Wisconsin. He's been a peony expert for many, many years. He's a fourth generation nurseryman and gardener and a great guy. He's going to talk all about the tree peony and some history and what you can, how to grow them.
How to grow them.
Yep.
Which, you know, it's not too terribly difficult, which is the good news.
Well, you
right?
put the roots down and the top up and,
exactly.
and add water. It's that old
that's right.
gardening trick.
And then leave it alone, right? That's kind of the cool thing about the tree peony. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
My fly-eating plants are doing well.
Fly-eating plants?
Yeah, I planted a Venus flytrap and a pitcher plant.
Uh-huh.
They're hardy here.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I've got them from a man in Indiana who might be a good story subject someday.
Mm-hmm.
He grows them in his yard, and he gave me a couple, and I put them out in a special place, half peat moss, half sand.
Mm-hmm. So good drainage.
Their little fly traps are operating.
Trapping.
Yeah, and the pitcher plant is a gorgeous,
it is. We've got
gorgeous
some pitcher
plants.
Plant. Yeah.
I had no idea.
Uh-huh.
So I'm excited about that, and I've got it in my butterfly garden, hoping they don't eat butterflies, because that would be wrong. I don't think their appetites are that size.
I don't think so either.
But it's just, I'm looking forward to it. It's a whole new aspect of something I hadn't done before. So
carnivorous gardening.
So life's all about.
Mm-hmm.
How about the wishy estate?
I'm a little stressed about certain, thank goodness. First, I thought we were going to lose one of our witch hazels that's been there for a really long time.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And it finally leafed out. But it was like everybody else leafed out, and it was just super slow to leaf out, right? So finally. And then... you look around all of our American hollies.
Yeah.
They look awful.
Yeah, mine took a whipping too.
Somebody the other day commented.
Uh-oh.
An arborist to boot.
He took it personally, obviously.
No, it was funny though, because he said, "What happened to all your hollies?" And I'm like, oh, well, let's see. The cicadas last year, the drought and heat last year, all the wind, the ice storm. So basically they're sparse and ratty looking. And then they've got all the little dead tips from the cicada damage. So the tips have flagged. So you've got brown flagging tips. So we need to get in there and prune out the dead.
But did they bloom okay for you?
They haven't done any of that quite yet.
Oh.
It's very, very slow to start.
I
go
guess.
And check to see, you know, if they've leafed out. Nothing has happened yet. But it has been a relatively cool sort of start to the season. So I'm not giving up. But I'm just really, really, really waiting for that new flush of growth.
Boy,
but they
I
look
guess.
Awful.
That's a 911 call.
It is a 911 call. And especially since there's like a dozen of them that look awful.
Ouch. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really scary. So, okay, my advice to myself.
Okay.
Be patient.
Write it down.
Right? Be patient. All right.
That's something I do all the time.
Yeah.
When I have time to be patient.
To be patient. Yeah. And then when you're not being patient, you're off doing things. And there are some pretty cool garden tours coming up this year. And now's your chance to get a passport at a good deal, right?
Yeah. It's the 2009 garden tour. You can get a passport to see the Crescent Hill Garden Tour on June 6th, Audubon Park Garden Tour on June 20th, and the Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden Tour on Saturday and Sunday, July 11th and 12th. One ticket. Available at Bunton Seed, Economy Aquatic Water Gardens, The Plant Kingdom, St. Matthew Feed and Seed, Thieneman's Urban Perennials, and Wallach Nursery and Garden Center. One ticket, all three gardens.
Sounds like a pretty good deal.
More information on our website.
Yeah, everybody wants a deal this time of the year, don't
yeah,
you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and another thing people want this time of the year is good gardening advice. So what better place to turn to than the Old Farmer's Almanac? And Sarah Peralta is joining us now. Sarah is the assistant editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, which was first published in 1792 and is clearly as relevant today as it was over 200 years ago. Sarah, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Listen, give us a general background on the Old Farmer's Almanac. It was published over 200 years ago, but, you know, who originally published it, and for what purposes?
Well, the 2009 edition is the 217th edition.
Wow.
It was started by Robert B. Thomas, who was a New England farmer, and he was an amateur astronomer, and he tried to figure out a way to use his knowledge in agriculture and astronomy to predict what possibly might be happening in the coming seasons, because he was a farmer and he needed to know for agriculture, for harvesting, for planting.
Sure.
So over a couple of years, he collected data and published his first Farmer's Almanac. Back then, it was just the Farmer's Almanac, not mm-hmm. the Old Farmer's Almanac. In 1792, we sold it for about 9 cents, and it was so spot on that the following year his subscriptions tripled.
Wow.
Well, was it stolen from Ben Franklin or Poor Richard? How'd that happen?
No, Ben Franklin is considered to us the father of all almanacs because he did have the first one, and we put him on the cover of ours in tribute.
I was just kidding.
Okay.
I know.
But back in the day, the almanac was something that was a very popular form of dispensing information, right?
Absolutely. It had everything from town meetings to holidays to postage rates, all kinds of different things.
Uh-huh. Was that something brought over from England when the settlers came, or Europe somewhere?
No, I don't believe so. And actually, we've had a lot of questions from people who have moved from here to England, and they say, what can I find over here that's just like the Old Farmer's Almanac?
Where's the almanac?
And we have no answer for them.
So a truly original American idea, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So, okay, 217 years. Was it published pretty much every year over the 217 year?
We are actually the only periodical in North America to have be continuously published for that amount of time.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we haven't missed a year yet.
Huh.
Did they take a shot at weather forecasting back then?
They called them not forecasts, but predictions. Yeah. It's kind of an overview. It's not as detailed as it is now because obviously they didn't have the same sort of technology that we have now. Mm-hmm. But they did give it a shot. Huh.
All right. The primary components of a good almanac include, what?
Well, you have to have a calendar. Uh-huh. So we have a calendar plus astronomical information in the calendars. That's our left-hand and our right-hand pages. You have to have all kinds of different sorts of astronomical, some astrological information. Uh-huh. And for our almanac, obviously, the weather is the main component.
Uh-huh. So how do you get, okay, today, as you said, you know, we're graced with different types of technologies that can assist us. So how do you guys go about compiling that important information?
We are still pretty much using the same formula that Robert B. Thomas devised, with a little bit more technology since it's available to us. But it's based on solar science, climatology, and meteorology, and that's what he was using back then.
Mm-hmm. So how did he go about doing it?
He had to study the stars, and he had to study nature's cycles and things like that. He didn't have, you know, he couldn't call up the National Weather Service and ask what the, you know, last 30-year period was.
He'd never heard of global warming either, which kind of confused things now, I guess.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he didn't know about global warming or global cooling.
Right.
So have you all been able to track that over the years in the almanac at all?
Well,
you know, cooling and warming trends?
We do recognize that humans have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
We don't necessarily take that into consideration when we're putting together our forecast.
Mm-hmm.
But usually we have a blanket statement of, you know, urbanization and greenhouse gases do have an effect on what we are predicting, but we're not using that as any kind of jumping off point.
Sure.
Well, I remember when I was a kid growing up around Chicago, one of the weather forecasters would put the almanac prediction on his desk and his prediction on his desk, and the almanac was ahead by 40% at one point in time, which I'd find hard to believe now. But do you keep track at all? Do you verify against what actually happens?
We do verify from year to year. So every year in your almanac, you can get an update of how we did the previous year.
Okay.
And for 2008, we were 90% accurate in predicting whether there would be more or less precipitation.
Hmm.
And our forecast for winter temperatures were within 1 degree of actual temperatures.
Wow. Yeah, so for us, let's see, the summer, or rather the winter weather map, 2008 and 2009 for Kentucky was cold and snowy.
It was cold.
Which I think it was, well, it was snowy and icy.
Yeah, yeah, big time
for us,
icy, yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Unfortunately, though, Sarah, the 2009 summer weather map for us is hot and dry. We don't need another one of those.
No, we don't. We reject that out of hand.
Yeah, rain is usually pretty nice to have sometimes during the summer.
Yeah, no kidding. So what are some of the main predictions that you guys are making for the country this year?
Well, June through August, which is what we consider summer, even though summer starts in the middle of June and ends in September.
Right.
But June through August, we are predicting will be hotter than normal in areas like Florida and New Mexico, just what they need, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then the temperatures elsewhere will be below normal on average.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, Florida is looking at above normal rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
So don't go to Florida this summer.
Yeah. But they do need the rain down there.
Yeah.
So
they do, but it's going to be hot. So,
yeah.
Everything's going to be dry, and then you have a...
Runoff down there.
Well, what's the forecast for Dublin, New Hampshire, where you're sitting?
Actually, we're going to be a little cooler than normal and wet, so not a very nice summer for us.
Oh, well. You were sort of talking about the whole, like, global warming issue, how you all try not to sort of emphasize that so much as a statement. But still, nonetheless, many of the trends that you all are seeing, I think, and highlighting, particularly in a new publication that is the 2009 stimulus package of sorts, as you all put it, but an all-season garden guide. And many of the issues in the garden guide, Sarah, are indeed sort of earth-friendly kind of green trends. So can you talk about how you all put the garden guide together for this year?
Sure. The garden guide comes out every spring, and we always try to highlight maybe a flower or a vegetable plus landscaping ideas that anybody can really do, whether an expert or a beginner. And actually, one of the more interesting ones this year is the rain garden for those areas that are expecting a lot of rain.
Uh-huh.
Instead of just letting it fall off your roof and water your lawn, you can create a garden where the rain will run down the garden a little bit and water your plants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great way to use what nature is giving you.
Right. For those areas in the U.S. that are not going to be getting a lot of rain, however, you've got some xeriscaping ideas as well, right?
Absolutely. Xeriscaping is becoming very popular, and mostly due to the fact that we've been having a lot of dry weather.
Mm-hmm.
So we have different plants for what area you're in. For anyone who doesn't know, xeriscaping is a way of planting using things that don't require a lot of water, like succulents and things like that.
How big a staff puts the almanac together? I've always been curious about that.
We have an editorial staff of 6 and that's one art director.
And also, I'm a retired newspaper columnist, and, you know, that business is falling apart. The whole paper industry seems to be falling apart. Is there a computer online component to the almanac now, and is that where it's going to go?
We do have a digital edition of the almanac that you can download right onto your computer if you don't want to purchase the paper. I don't believe the garden guide's available in that capacity yet, but we recognize some people would rather just have everything on their desktop, and, you know, it's actually a little bit, I don't want to say it's better, but when you get the digital edition, any links that are in the books will automatically hotlink to wherever, you know, we're expecting you to go.
Mm-hmm. Well,
what is your circulation, and how's it holding up?
We print 3 million every year. And from what I hear from our distributors, it's selling really well this year. We don't have a lot of returns so far. So we're really pleased with its progress.
Especially right now. You know, Bob said, okay, newspaper business and print is struggling, but the economy's struggling. People are a little bit more interested in alternative forms of subsistence, et cetera. Do you think that this is kind of the natural thing to sort of look to sort of in a comfort food sort of way? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. It's nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
You had one in your grandparents' house or your parents' house, so you want to have one in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, the Old Farmer's Almanac, we're really sort of all natural. You know, it's I'm not sure if that's the correct term, but old ideas that still work now.
Yeah.
everybody's trying to grow their own vegetables or home remedies that they can find in their kitchen. Mm-hmm. And really, the almanac has a lot of those things in it.
Yeah, it was green before green was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It was.
That is comforting somehow.
Well, it's the kind of thing I like to put next to my bed at night and just kind of pick it up and read it and look at it. And it's just kind of fun to have.
Yeah.
It really is a book that you can pick up and read all year long. I mean, especially since you have the calendars in there. So every month you can look and see what's happening on this day in history or what sort of astronomical highlights are going to be going on in your area in the sky that night.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really something to keep around all year.
Good. So how long does it take you all to put together one?
It takes us quite a while. We've actually...
The six of you.
just finished our first round of edits to the 2011, and we started those in, I think, March.
Okay.
Wow. 2011.
So you've got 10 done then.
10 is gone to the printer.
Okay. All right. So we'll be watching. We'll be watching for that one. When do they actually get put out?
They come out usually the very beginning of September. Our official release day is always the second Tuesday in September.
Sarah, there's a couple of other kind of companions that you guys are working on as well. There's a cookbook. There's kid theme almanacs as well. Can you tell us a little bit about those and what they offer?
Sure. Really excited about the Old Farmer's Almanac for Kids Volume 3, which will come out this summer. That is geared for kids and kids at heart starting at age 8. It's 192 pages of full color, facts, trivia, history. It's so much fun to put together.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear from a lot of the kids that read it. They have their own website, almanac4kids.com.
Mm-hmm.
And they all seem to enjoy it. And it's a lot of fun to put together. Very different from the regular almanac, which is black and white.
Yeah.
So it's a little different.
So what kind of information are you highlighting in there? Just like cool, similar to what the adult version is, but just more kid related, kind of get them excited about the natural world and what's going on around them in the skies.
Yes, it's separated into different categories. So you have an on the farm section, in the garden, history, amusing things, you know, that would just be
entertaining.
Uh-huh. Yeah, something that doesn't necessarily have any sort of tie to history, but it's an amusing article.
Mm-hmm.
Sports, astronomy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's just full color is so much fun, I think, when we go from the black and white pages from the Old Farmer's Almanac.
Well, have you ever thought about an Old Farmer of the Month calendar?
Bob can be the first submission.
I'm talking bib overalls. I'm not talking about
that. Yeah, that's what I mean.
You want pictures of farmers every month?
Well, sure. Old Farmers of the Month calendar. It'd be a knockout in the Midwest.
Oh, funny. Hey, Sarah, do you actually have any idea what percentage of your readers are actually farmers?
I think we did a study just recently, and I think the numbers that came out was 25%, so not very many.
Well, I think that's pretty good.
Well, full-time farmers, not, doing it as a hobby.
There's not many farmers left.
There's
either.
Not that many full-time farmers, exactly.
Right.
I think that's a pretty good percentage, 25%.
Out of 3 million if they sell that many.
Yeah,
sure.
Kidding. All right, the cookbook companion, where do you get your recipes from? Are these like recipes that are submitted from the 25% of the farmers' wives that are reading?
Well,
or,
wait a minute.
Yeah.
Guys can submit recipes.
This is true. If
Thank
they
you.
Can cook.
Not me, but...
The Old Farmer's Almanac cookbook is new. That came out in the fall.
Okay.
And we think it's over 400 recipes, if I remember correctly.
Uh-huh.
And it's recipes that have been in our archive or have been in... Some of our products, they come off our website. We took the top 10 rated recipes from our website, which are just everyday people submit those recipes, but we took the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a section that came from us, the staff,
so
our family favorites. And it's just a nice mix of everything from breads and sweets to fish and pasta and potatoes. And it's just a cookbook that you can use for no matter what you're cooking. If you're cooking a fancy dinner, if you're just cooking regular Wednesday night dinner, it's just something that you can use every day. And it's filled with 180 tips, like what to do if you oversalt your soup or things like that.
Cancel the party.
Has the almanac stayed in the same printing family for a long time?
It has. It's only switched hands, I think, about 3 times.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And Yankee Publishing has it right now, right?
Yes, and we are the sister publication of Yankee Magazine, which is a New England-based...
That's a good magazine.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank
you. When you do the calendar, let me know.
Yeah.
I will call you.
I'll be there.
Okay, and we'll get some good pictures.
I got some bib overalls. I'll come right on up to Dublin, New Hampshire.
Right. Sounds good. May not be one of your best sellers, though.
Hey, you never know.
You never
Make
know.
Make it July, will you? Because I'd like to go to New Hampshire in July and leave here.
So. All right, there you go. Sarah, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Sarah Peralta is the assistant editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, published by Yankee Publishing in Dublin, New Hampshire. For more information on the Old Farmer's Almanac or the All Seasons Garden Guide and anything else, please go to our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, Roy Clem and the illustrious Tree Peony. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Getting ready to talk about really one of my favorite flowers in the spring, the peonies.
The peonies.
Particularly the tree peonies.
Yeah. The herbaceous peonies, as fabulous as they are, the star really is the tree peony because the blooms are enormous.
Yeah, but
and the shape is so sculptural because it literally is a woody plant.
Right, yeah.
And then the foliage is very big and bold. And even after the flowers fade, Bob, that seed pod, if you leave those on, you've got interest there as well. So the tree peony is definitely something to consider investing in for the long-term interest of your garden.
Investments are right because they're pretty pricey, too.
Yeah, they are.
It can be very expensive, but they're worth it. We get the guy to tell us all about them. Fourth-generation nurseryman Roy Clem and his wife Sarah are owners of Song Sparrow Nursery in southern Wisconsin, where he has been hybridizing, growing, and selling peonies, among many other plants, by mail order for more than 20 years. Roy's with us today to talk about the history and culture of tree peonies, many of which he developed himself. Roy, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, hi, Bob.
Yeah, that's me. Before we get started on tree peonies, give us a little background on the Clem family nursery and Song Sparrow itself.
Well, I was lucky enough to grow up in a horticulture family. Great-grandpa started way back in, I think, 1852 in northern Illinois. And I think peonies came into the system in the early 1900s. I know Grandpa Charlie was a charter member of the American Peony Society in 1903. My dad had some interest in tree peonies, so while I was in high school and college, I saw them in the company. But I'm self-taught as far as the propagation of them and the advancing of all these new varieties we're doing because I really thought they were a special flower.
Mm-hmm.
Song Sparrow is an offshoot of the Clem Nursery in Champaign-Urbana. We started Song Sparrow about 1996, and we came to southern Wisconsin, Bob, because the soil is so good here. It's in the Rock County Prairie, and it's about 4 feet thick without any rocks and gravel in the soil. But below that 4 feet thickness of soil, there's a gravel underlayment, so we have perfect drainage on the farm.
Huh.
And we're in plant zone 4B, 5A, so whatever lives here is nice and rock bone hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. How about tree peonies themselves? Give us some background and history on those beautiful creatures.
Well, there's American hybrids that were done especially the 1940s, 1950s, by Professor Saunder and then later on by William Gratwick and Nassau Staffness. And I think they're maybe the choicest tree peonies we have. Third and fourth generation hybrids, lots of pearled ivories and beautiful color combinations, nice and hardy. We also have the best of the Japanese hybrids. See, about 900 years ago, the Buddhist monks from Japan went to China and took the Chinese varieties to Japan and hybridized them to be much superior garden plants than the Chinese varieties, in my opinion. Their flowers are airy, and they're held way above the foliage, and they're really gorgeous. But a lot of the varieties got mixed, especially with two world wars where the Japanese were involved in, and so it took us a while to separate out maybe the 10 or 12 best Japanese mutans. We sell those, and we have the Japanese a rough Japanese translation for the names they have ascribed to them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few European varieties we still sell. They have beautiful flowers, but oftentimes their flowers hang into the foliage, so you have to pick them to enjoy them. One special tree peony, of course, is the variety Joseph Rock, which came from seed from a Buddhist lamasery in 1926 in the Hunan province. That's basically, I think we have we're propagating probably over 150 varieties. There might be 100 on the website right now.
Mm-hmm. So, Roy, in terms of the species of the tree peony versus like the herbaceous peonies, how many different species are there? Or is there just
I think the basic difference is a woody or a tree peony makes its buds for next year above the ground.
Okay.
Sort of a different kind of garden plant.
Okay.
A herbaceous peony makes its buds for next year below the ground.
Sure.
So they die down to the ground each year.
Okay.
Like an asparagus or a rhubarb.
Uh-huh.
Or a woody tree peony, you have to treat like a hydrangea. You know, it's going to grow a little bit every year and eventually get to be probably in our climate, Midwest climates, maybe 6 feet high, 5 feet wide in 20 years.
Wow.
If you have good growing ground. Otherwise,
yeah.
Figure it to be a 3 to 4 feet shrub.
Mm-hmm. So as such, then, it becomes a little more tricky for people. The herbaceous peonies at the end of the season, the foliage, you know, naturally gets killed back. You clean it up.
Right. Clean it up.
What kind of, you know, care does the tree peony require?
I would treat it like a herbaceous shrub, like a woody shrub.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a mulch is effective, slow-release fertilizer in the spring. When the buds pop, you can see if there's any dead or damaged wood in the shrub and just prune that out.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it. It can take full sun, quarter shade, third shade, maybe up to half shade.
Okay.
It can grow closer to big shrubs and trees. A herbaceous peony likes to be by itself.
Uh-huh.
The tree peonies, because they're woody, they sort of have a nice association with other woody plants. They're wonderful. I mean, they get so much. They get better with age and better with age, and they become just garden jewels and garden heirlooms with time.
So in the average garden setting, you really wouldn't have to prune it at all. You would just want to sort of take on its natural form as
For
it ages.
Right. 5 or 6 years, I would just try to let it grow and start maturing a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We know we sell four and 5 year old specimens containerized, so it's almost like planting a potted rose.
Mm-hmm.
You just take it out of the container gently, and you plant the whole root system, and it's almost foolproof, you know, way to grow them and get them started.
They're typically a little bit more expensive, right? Because
they are
because of the
time put in them, and we have to graft them to propagate them.
Okay.
Now I get some tip dieback. Is that normal here in winter?
Because they grow so fast. The last growth in the season is not woody, it's herbaceous.
Okay.
You can
see that by the buds they form in the leaf axle.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, a really woody plant would form really nice buds in every leaf axle for next year.
Mm-hmm.
And a herbaceous plant doesn't do that. So the last 4 or 5 inches of a plant, oftentimes, you have to cut back.
So, Roy, if a plant... And I'm asking this selfishly because this indeed happened to me. a tree peony that my father had planted years ago died back down to the ground, but it suckers from the roots.
Right.
Is that going to perpetually be a herbaceous peony now that will never bloom?
I've seen tree peonies sucker from the root system, but they were tree peonies.
Okay, so be patient and see if
it's a herbaceous or woody.
Okay.
We've had a tough winter, at least in our climate. We probably had a zone 3 or zone 4 winter. And some of the tree peonies that are exposed, the top will die above the snow line. But they'll shoot, if they're on their own roots, they'll shoot nice true to type shoots up. Easy to tell when they get going.
Mm-hmm.
When we graft tree peonies, we try to graft them on a herbaceous understock that never forms adventitious buds on its roots.
Okay.
So you'd never have... You know, these bad suckers coming up from the bottom of the plant.
Yeah.
Well, Roy, take us through the hybridizing process. I know you've done a lot of that with peonies. How does that work?
Well, a lot of tree peonies have both the male and female part. If you have a blossom bob with both parts, you try to pollinate it with pollen from another variety before that particular blossom's pollen dehisses. If it dehisses and throws, it might pollinate itself. So I try to pollinate the female tree peonies really, really early in their bloom cycle. And once it's pollinated, the seeds ripen maybe middle of September. They're little black seeds, oftentimes 3 to 4 per little seed container area of a flower.
Mm-hmm.
I pick those and I plant them in deep flats, and oftentimes I have to wait 2 years for those seeds to come up. Because peony seeds have a double dormancy. They have a seed coat dormancy that takes one winter to break, and they have an internal physiological dormancy that takes another winter to break.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wait 2 years for them to come up, and when they come up, they're only like 5 to 6 inches tall. It takes them about 4 years to bloom after that.
It's a Barbie peony.
It's a long time, and then you're looking at a teenager blooming, and you want to try to judge it as a young adult blooming.
Yeah.
Okay, then if you pick out a good one, gee, this is a really nice one. I'm going to call it Bob Hill or a nice honorable name like that.
Yeah, it'll work.
You've got one plant. What do you do with one plant? Mm-hmm. Then you start the propagation process. And then, you know, you try to build up some stock plants, say 10 or 12 mother plants that you can keep propagating from. So it's oftentimes a 20, 25-year process to get a new peony variety, whether it be woody peony or herbaceous peony, into the marketplace. Mm-hmm.
So how many do you have growing at one time there at Song Sparrow?
Tree peonies?
Yeah, tree peonies and herbaceous both. I know you've got
a bunch. Tree peony, see, when we graft them in late summer, they're out in the field for 2 years. And after 2 years, we dig them in October and containerize them in our selling container. And they can go on inventory when they're rooted in. So that takes about from October, say, of 09 till August of 10. And we have like six houses of tree peony, 100-foot houses, ready to sell all the time, roughly 2,500 in a house. So that's how many we have in selling. And then we always have a two-year program behind it in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Herbaceous, we start with a little 1 to 2 eye liner in the field, and we grow them 2 years. And then we sell them at 2 years old and 3 years old. And I would guess we're at 500 or 600 varieties of herbaceous peonies.
Wow.
Maybe 30 acres worth. We probably go through maybe 400,000 to 500,000 peonies in a false dig season.
Wow. But how many of those have you actually developed at Song Sparrow?
Only the good ones.
Of course.
I haven't added up, but I imagine I maybe have hybridized, 120, 130 varieties.
Okay.
We don't always sell them every year because we don't have enough.
Right.
And we give breeder credit on the website to whoever hybridized them. So if there's one name, that's the person that hybridized them and introduced them.
Mm-hmm.
If there's two names, it means one person hybridized them, but the second person introduced and marketed them.
Sure.
And we have that with a lot of people who are deceased, and we took on their work to finish it off. But then my dad's varieties would be breeder credit, and my grandpa's too, and I think we actually have a part of the website where you can go right to the breeder, and it'll bring up everything that particular breeder has done.
Uh-huh.
We've given breeder credit on tree peonies, herbaceous peonies, emerald callus, and hostas.
Okay.
There's such an active market in breeding right now.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, could you recommend, the varieties matter? Would something that do well in Louisville not do as well in southern Wisconsin? What would you recommend for the Louisville area?
Probably, I would think the further south you go, the more you should drift to the early bloomers with the light petalage.
Okay.
Because when they bloom late, your summers are so hot already, it sort of cooks them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And when they have more petalage to open, it's harder for the flower to open. So anything we designate as a hybrid on the herbaceous side would be good for Louisville or the early bloomers. On the woody peonies, we also rate them early, mid, and late. And I would almost think on tree peonies, you could probably grow every variety in Louisville to grow it well.
When you say early, mid, and late, what's early and then what's late?
Well, it would probably be a 6 to 10 day difference.
Okay.
Depending on the weather. I have the first peonies blooming. I live in the Zone 5 garden.
Mm-hmm.
And so right around May 5th, the first ones open, the very, very earliest. And the last ones open, say, in my garden, June 15th, June 20th.
Okay.
They're like 5 or 6 week blooming season.
Okay, so we're probably a couple weeks ahead of
I would think so.
Yeah.
In fact, mine, which I got from Song Sparrow, bloomed in mid to late April. They were just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Mine are in bloom presently, so, yeah.
What are some good companion plants, or is there such a thing for tree peonies?
Oh, yeah. In my garden, in the peony area, I like to use Baptisia.
Right.
Because they sort of take a while to establish themselves, and they make a similar kind of bush. I like to use emerald callus because they fit in so easily in the sunny areas, and of course they bloom a month later, and that helps them.
Mm-hmm.
I like to use dwarf conifers, Bob, because you can't, I love dwarf conifers, and they take forever to grow, and you can't buy big ones. They're either not available or they're too expensive, so you buy the little ones, and you think about the bones of your garden in the future and place those where they're going to have room. You can always move peonies and daylilies and baptisias and things around. So dwarf conifers are a good candidate. little dwarf shrubs like dwarf lilacs and dwarf daphnes and things like that are really good candidates also.
I think they do. I think the tree peony is really just a great addition to any sort of mixed border where you do have perennials and woody shrubs and all of that. It's overlooked often.
The other thing is a lot of them have foliage that almost looks like Japanese maples.
Yeah, it does.
So you have really good foliage after that, too.
And really good like architectural, sculptural effect in the wintertime, the way that the wood is sort of gnarled. And
yeah, it's sort of,
you know.
It's like the ugliest thing in the winter.
But it's not.
And it metamorphosizes into the most beautiful, gorgeous, exotic flowers you can imagine. I mean, that metamorphosis to me is just a wonder of northern horticulture.
I think they've got a really cool sculptural effect in the winter. I don't think they're terribly ugly.
Well, I know you hate to transplant anything like that, but if you leave your house or have to change gardens, how and when would you transplant a tree peony?
Well, I think the best time would probably be in mid to late fall. Cut the foliage off so they don't desiccate water. You can move them bare root or you can move them with a little ball. Or just the crack of spring because they grow so early in the spring. I've had good success in my garden. Again, we're zone 5. I would say third to fourth week in October. So you might be a little bit later because your falls are warmer than ours.
Right.
So probably Louisville, I would guess, second week in November.
Mm-hmm. And has Song Sparrow got any special new tree peonies coming out in the next year or two?
Yes, we do.
Go ahead and brag.
Tell us about them.
When you get the new ones, we've worked on the ones from Sir Peter Smithers, the late Sir Peter Smithers, and most of those are on the website and for sale, but we still have a few coming out yet.
Uh-huh.
I found out he was Naval Intelligence in World War II with Ian Fleming.
Wow.
Oh,
and
yeah?
And Ian based a lot of his early books and stories on what Sir Peter did in the war.
Wow.
And oftentimes in Ian Fleming's books, there's a Smithers character.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And in Goldfinger, there was a golden typewriter. It's when Sir Peter and Ian were assigned to the Caribbean War Theater to try to solve the sinking of all our ships.
Uh-huh.
Sir Peter was single, and he married an American woman and married her in 30 days, and she was a journalist, and she had a golden typewriter.
Huh. Oh.
Her name was Dojean, and there's a tree peony named in her honor, Dojean.
As there should be.
Yeah. So we're working on that. And then there's an awful lot are coming up from New Zealand in the southern hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to first acclimate them to our climate, mm-hmm. our hemisphere, and then I have to judge them for hardiness and beauty and fragrance and all the things we judge. And those will be coming on the market next.
Mm-hmm.
Funny thing about those New Zealand and Australian varieties, most of them were hybridized in Wisconsin. In Manitowoc by Bill Seidel, who sold seed of controlled crosses to the southern hemisphere years ago, and now we have to bring them back to the northern hemisphere, back to Wisconsin, in a matter of fact, to get them marketed.
Uh-huh.
Get them eating cheese again, right?
So, there you go, yeah.
So maybe it won't be so difficult to get them acclimated to Wisconsin.
Well, I don't think they are because it takes a couple years to get them hemispherically acclimated, but
uh-huh.
I think the hardiness is there because I know the hybridizer, and he was using hardy, uh-huh. Clones to make all these crosses.
So, it just sort of clicked with me, hemispherically acclimated, because they need to sort of switch their entire season of dormancy and of, even if they go dormant in the southern hemisphere, they probably don't even, huh?
Well, they bloom down there
at Christmas.
Thanksgiving time,
yeah.
You know?
Wow. Right.
Huh. So they're all, it's like taking a lefty basketball player and making him shoot right-handed.
Yeah, so what is that process like, just like letting the plant?
Well, we try to, let me see, we get them in late winter, early spring,
mm-hmm.
which for them would be early fall, mid-fall.
Right.
And we try to give them enough dormant period in refrigerated storage. We pot them like July 1st and give them a real short summer.
Okay.
Bring them back into dormancy. In November,
naturally.
But then we don't give them. We try to keep those houses like at 28 degrees, so they don't get -28.
Okay.
And get them used to, and they acclimate.
Huh.
It takes a while, but then they don't know where they're at anymore, and they're in the northern hemisphere.
I've never thought about that. That's actually
either.
Really interesting.
They have funny accents for a while.
Yeah, no kidding.
They bungee jump.
They might have funny accents. Yeah.
All right. Well, the tree peony definitely something for gardeners to keep their eye out for. They are typically a little bit more expensive, but definitely worth it, like any other long-term woody investment is in the garden.
Yeah. Well, I think so, and I think they should be called probably shrubaceous or woody peonies because they don't really grow up like a little tree.
Okay, so we'll call them
they're
woody
peonies. Shrub.
I like shrubaceous.
But they're a woody shrub. You don't have to cut them back to the ground.
Shrubaceous. You must have hired a new writer.
By the way, there's a lot of yellow in the woody peonies, too, which you don't have in a herbaceous.
Oh, mine yellow one is just unbelievable. I just
sit
out there.
Yeah, a lot of different colors.
Oh, uh-huh. That's incredible.
All right.
Well, Roy, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Indeed, sir.
It's been fun, and thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Fourth-generation nurseryman Roy Clem and his wife Sarah are owners of Song Sparrow Nursery in southern Wisconsin, where he's been growing, hybridizing, and selling tree peonies for more than 20 years. For more information on Roy or Song Sparrow Nursery, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And we've got some questions. But first, before we get to our traditional questions, Bob, there was a message on our Homegrown question line, which is a little answering machine.
Her name is Rhonda, I think.
Yeah. Kevin Hollis called, and he's involved in horticulture, a consultant, and does, you know, work for people. And he had asked us graciously to remind people that crepe myrtles are really slow to pop in the spring.
Yes, they are.
They are plants that like it warm. Similarly, if you get annuals like verbena and lantana, they like the heat. So they'll kind of sit there until, bam, it gets hot, and then they really start to perform. Crepe myrtles are infamous for being slow to pop in the spring. They are fabulous summer bloomers around here. They typically don't start to bloom until what I like to call high summer, which is July, August.
Right.
You know, you got them blooming in September still. So be patient. One of the ways that you can tell, of course, if a woody plant is still viable is to do a very soft scratch test. You take your nail, you don't want to gouge out anything. Take your nail and scratch on the wood, and if it's soft and a little bit of that bark comes off and reveals a green cambium layer beneath, that plant is alive and well.
I use a machete sometimes on that. No, I'm just kidding. And it's funny because 20 years ago, I think they were considered less hardy here, crepe myrtles, because of the warmer summers. They're much more common.
Yeah.
And they're great, strong bloomers.
They are.
In late summer.
And I would recommend, too, sort of, a lot of people don't prune them properly. They'll, like, head them back, kind of top them.
Exactly.
And really what you want to do is let them be free form and limb them up, because the more age you get on them, you're going to get that nice peeling bark. So limb up anything that's sort of chest high and below to reveal the sculptural form of the plant, and then you get the nice blooms on top.
Yeah, I've let mine go now for 5 years. It looks like a stewardia almost.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful exfoliating
ours
bark.
Are like 20 some odd years plus and going. Can you believe it?
Yeah,
they're beautiful.
Yes.
They're beautiful. The peeling bark, absolutely beautiful.
Okay. A regular question now.
Okay.
This is from Rebecca. Dear Bob or Janine, I lost an aristocrat pear due to the hurricane force winds last fall. I'm not crazy about the pear trees, but this tree provided great shade in my backyard. Do you have any suggestions for a shade tree in the small Highlands yard? I don't want a slow grower or one that makes a mess. Other than that, she's
open to it.
Right.
Let's see, Rebecca. A lot of people have been asking similar questions. You know, want something that's a little bit smaller. And honestly, some really cool trees that Bob and I, you know, have consistently suggested include the hornbeam, the Parodia, and the Zilkova. They're going to be a little bit more narrow, good for a smaller yard.
Great bark.
Yeah, and all very beautiful bark on all of them.
Something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, ultimately, don't you think, Bob, your best bet is to go to a local nursery in your area, see what they have, talk to the people there, you know, tell them what your backyard's truly like, and, you know, throw out some of the ideas that we might suggest, you know, see what you like too, if you've never even seen these trees before, but you really need to kind of hit the ground and see what's out there and see what appeals to you.
Or go on some of these garden tours we mentioned earlier.
Absolutely.
That's a great way to see, different trees in different places and fall in love with different plants.
Yeah, it really is. All right, this one's from Margaret Lawrence. Hi, what type of mulch do you recommend for perennial flower beds? I usually use whatever's cheapest, but a friend of mine told me that there can be problems with mold and recommended pine needles. What do you think?
Pine needles are good. Mm-hmm. If you can get them, I think they're a little more pricey than, it depends on how many you need, but they come in big bundles. You use them a lot, I think.
Yeah, I do. I prefer pine needles in like chunky, like the pine nuggets, the big chunks.
Right.
And not necessarily the whole mold thing. It's the more air that can get to your plants, the better, to be honest with you. And some of that hardwood mulch, you know, the black mulch, if you use too much, it crusts over. And then you don't have good oxygen and you don't have good water penetration as well. So the chunkier, the better, basically. And
yeah,
pine needles are fabulous.
Yeah, I use hardwood because I have so much to cover, but I don't put it on thick. That's a sin. You see some of these trees planted along streets that just have this cone of mulch.
Mm-hmm. Bad, and it'll kill your tree.
It will.
That's why some trees fail. It's
awful.
Your fault because you overmulched it.
And a last question, kind of a similar question. A guy from Granville, Ohio. Mm-hmm. I had no idea our signal went that
far. Our friend John McKinney, great listener up in Ohio.
Yep. I don't think I've heard you discuss peat moss, which I've always, for some reason, always been partial to. The obvious negative is the cost, but over and above that, is it both a decent mulch and organic fertilizer in one?
Well, my impression about that, John, is totally not cost effective,
yeah, right.
for one. Exactly. And having corresponded with John rather frequently, I suspect that his garden's rather big, so definitely not cost effective. Number two, composted manures and compost would do much more to improve the soil and actually feed your plants than peat would. And then a third that I know very, very little about, but I somebody brought this up once, that there's a little controversy in terms of the ecology of like harvesting top grade peat because it comes from the peat bogs, i.e. it's really expensive because it's not necessarily as renewable as it should be, kind of thing. But like I said, I don't know the details of that. So
just takes a few million years.
Yeah. Compost, I think, is our best bet.
Exactly.
All right. If you've got a question, you can get a hold of us in several different ways.
Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. You know, Miss Wishy, I always thought this word meant tall or upright.
Something altogether different.
But you hear the first part of it and you think, tall and upright.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. But it doesn't at all, does it?
It doesn't. Help me out here.
The Latin word of the week this week is verticillata. Verticillatus, verticillatum, you know, et cetera. But verticillata doesn't mean vertical.
It should.
But verticillata means having whorls forming around an axis.
Like a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Well, it's latte.
No, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So, for example, Adenophora verticillata, which is narrow-leafed ladybells.
Yep.
And I haven't had Adenophora in the garden in forever. It occurred to me when I was looking up these words.
I've never had it.
Oh, it's super cool. Asclepias verticillata, world milkweed.
Milkweed, yeah.
So think about, milkweed's a good example. Think about how the kind of common-looking milkweed is, how the leaves whirl around the stem.
They do.
That's verticillata.
Oh.
Okay. Coreopsis verticillata, world tick seed.
Yeah.
So world mintha, mint cross verticillata. Remember the mint leaves whirled around the stem, right?
You got it.
Vertical, you know, right across from each other, you know, that whole thing, but whirled around the stem. Fritillaria, think about what fritillaria looks like.
Perfect.
Verticillata. It's all, that little kind of cap whirled around.
Exactly.
How about, I've never heard of this plant before, but I really love the name. Hydrilla verticillata.
Water thyme.
Water thyme. And thyme, of course, is in the mint family, as we learned a couple of weeks ago. Ilex verticillata.
Winterberry.
Winterberry,
one of my favorite plants.
One of the deciduous hollies.
Mm-hmm.
Check it out. How are the berries on the stems, Bob?
They're
world, they are. They're all like white, right up close against the stem.
World renowned.
Mm-hmm. Lysimachia verticillata.
The world loosestrife.
World loosestrife. Salvia verticillata.
Lilac sage.
Lilac sage.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, again, Mint Family, the whole world around the square stem. I could go on and on.
Apparently,
but yes, verticillata having whorls forming around an axis. So there you have it. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to visit Creasy Mahan Nature Preserve.
Homegrown is produced by the very stable Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.